This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, a fantasy author publishing under James E. Reed. My newest fantasy series is going strong. Readers have enjoyed Diamond Stained. Now Oban and Navina return for their fifth and final story. Things have never been more dangerous. The entirety of the five-book Secret of the Jewels series is out on Amazon and free in Kindle Unlimited. And on Tuesday, September 17th, The Ale House War debuts on Amazon, a satirical fantasy novella I co-wrote with Michael Evan. It chronicles the war between the harbor seals and the walruses over the most precious substance in the world, beer. Today, I'm joined by Nikki Nelson Hick. She is a creative fantasy author some describe as the unholy love child of Flannery O'Connor and H.P. Lovecraft.
How are you doing today, Nikki?
I am doing really, really well. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. Still can't open my windows because the West Coast is burning and it is a smoky haze out there.
I know. I've seen the pictures. It looks like an apocalypse. I'm in Tennessee and it's pretty cool here. It's pretty nice.
I'm in Washington, so it's not where it's really burning. We're just getting the smoke from Oregon.
Oh, so you're just getting the smoke because
so it's not the like really bad. It looks like a foggy day, except for the fog doesn't. It's not quite fog, but yeah, that's just what it.
Well, we're having the hurricanes and stuff. They're going down Louisiana. They're starting to move their way up here, but I'm in Gallatin, which is like upper Tennessee towards near Kentucky line. So we don't get a lot of the bad weather. It tends to stay pretty north of us or go straight to Kentucky because God seems to have a real hate boner for Kentucky. I don't know why, but it always seems to go right over Gallatin. I think we have a witch.
Okay.
I've often thought about that. We have like a witch who just keeps things away from Gallatin. So I've only lived here for 3 years. So it's just really weird. The weather here is always just nice.
Yeah, we get windstorms, but they rarely even hit like a category one. Like I think one in my entire life hit a category one, and that knocked out my family's power for 6 days.
Oof, that's rough.
Yeah, that was the inauguration day storm, the day Bill Clinton took office.
Oh no. Well, that's blame the Clintons. So
my family's Christian. I knew some people that were like, when he took his second office, they're like, all right, are we going to get hit again?
So I was living in California when Clinton was in office. And I just remember him clogging up the I-5. I'm trying to get home from work and I can't get home from work because he has to get a haircut. And it made me so angry. So him and O.J. Simpson clogging up the I-5, I was really pissed off.
The nice thing about living in Washington is politicians ignore us. So.
Oh.
Because it's a blue state through and through, so the Republicans don't care and the Democrats don't care because we're Washington. We're not an important state.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. Well,
I'm a blue streak in a red state, so anyway.
So, all right, I like to start out with some fun questions. Yep. So are you an elf person or a dwarf person?
You know, I don't really trust the elves too much, but I think I like to go drinking with the dwarves, but kind of talk philosophy with the elves, although I think the elves would look down on you the entire time. Yeah, I guess I'm really more of a dwarf person really then.
Yeah, that's really the correct answer. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the correct. The elves are pretty and stuff, but they're such snobs.
Yeah, like you see past the superficial.
Yes. Good. And you can't trust them. Don't trust the elves or the fae folk. Mm-mm, no.
Definitely not the fae folk.
Mm-mm. Although I'm doing a lot of research on djinn.
Don't trust them either.
Don't trust them, but don't piss them off. I don't think I'd piss off the djinn any more than the fae is one thing, but the djinn, because this house we bought this house 3 years ago from two witches, and they told me that they were leaving behind some fairies who said they wanted to stay to take care of us, and I've been like, yay, and it's been really weird, because I think that the spell must have died, because trust me, the garden is dead. I cannot keep that thing up. But yes, I've often worried that we've upset the fae around here, but the djinn are scarier, I think, than fae.
I don't know. It depends on what you mean by scary. I think the fae, like, are more insidious than the gin, maybe.
Well, depends on what gin you're talking about. There's so many types of gin.
True.
But yeah. Oh my gosh. But the fae.
It depends the type of the fae too. But yeah, like I don't know. I think
the fae like to play with us more than the gin. The gin are more like older cousins that are kind of like, ugh. You know, they don't want to deal with this little bitty people of the dirt. But the fae are like, ha ha ha. How can I screw with these people more? And just they like to mess with us more than the gin. The gin are a little bit more like, ugh. I ain't got time for this crap. I got things to do.
Okay. Okay. I did not expect us to go down this route.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I've been doing a lot of research on gin lately, so I'm kind of in a gin hole. So.
Well, why are you researching gin? Is it for a book?
No, really. Actually, it's a podcast that I found. And the deal is, I used to live in Muscat, Oman.
Okay.
And there's a city near Muscat that is called Nizwa. And Nizwa is a city of magicians. And the thing is, if you bought the nobody would buy anything in Nizwa because city of magicians and gin. And the story was, if you bought a goat in Nizwa, by the time you got it back to Muscat, it'd be a pig because it'd be a goat. It'd be a spell on it. So when I was living in Oman, I used to do a lot of stuff by going to souks and looking for pieces of their pagan past. I have a collection of somps and czar rings, which are used in exorcism rituals to get rid of djinn. So anyway, I've always had that interest. And then I found this really cool podcast called The Hidden Djinn. I'm like, what? And it's really good. It's about 20, 30 minutes, that real sweet spot. And it's really, really interesting. It talks about the history of not only just of djinn, but how the stories of the djinn have interacted in all the different legends throughout the world. And it's fascinating. It's a great podcast. You want to check it out? Check it out. It's called The Hidden Djinn. It's really good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm obsessive. I go down holes.
Oman, isn't that where Majelis al-Jinn is located?
I do not know. I do know Sinbad. That's where the story of Sinbad started.
Yeah. Well, do you know what Majelis al-Jinn is?
No.
It is the second largest, like, single cave in the world, but the Arabs call it Majelis al-Jinn. I believe it's like the home of the jinn.
And I wouldn't be surprised.
There's like a hole in the roof, and you can just go down to this huge, vast underground chamber. And I think it's in Oman. It's down there on the southern coast of the Arabian Peninsula.
It probably isn't. So there are Yemen. When I was in Nizwa, went to Nizwa on a little trip. They had this, it was a spirit cave. They call it the spirit cave. And they told us that's where a djinn lives. And they said, there were all these little plates of halwa, which is this really thick, syrupy, gluey junk. And it's like a sweet treat. And they have these plates of halwa all over the cave because the people, even though they're very devout Muslim, the pagan past of Oman is still there. It's way underground, but it's still there. And these people would leave halwa for the spirits, the djinn, and who live inside the cave. I didn't see any djinn, but I saw a lot of fat goats. So many fat diabetic goats walking around eating the halwa. But ever since then, I've always been kind of cool about djinns because, you know, again, I lived in Oman for a while, and it's kind of, especially with Nizwa, being the home of the djinn. And after listening to that podcast, I'm a little scared about what lives underneath trees. So that's where they like to live, near trees or caves. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. No, it's fine. I Googled Majelis al-Jinn because I researched it for something I wrote once. But yeah, it's actually close to Muscat.
Oh, Muscat. Yes. Muscat's a great
Well, not
place.
Close. It's like 100 kilometers. So it's like an hour or two drive.
Yeah. Oh, Muscat's. Well, we lived there back in 99, 2000. And Sultan Qaboos was the ruling guy. He died this year, actually. And he was great. He was a lovely man. He allowed all religions to flourish except for Judaism. But everybody else could do what they wanted to do. And he allowed women to go to school. He brought electricity and running water into Oman. Before then, they didn't even have electricity. Can you believe that? 20th century. And he was a great man. Also gay. It was one of those hidden, everybody knew he was gay. But he was a really, really very good man. I have no idea who took over since he's died this year. But Oman's a beautiful place. And everyone there is so sweet and nice. Really nice.
All right. Well. Anyway. I think we've talked enough about Oman. Let's talk about your writing career. So how long have you wanted to be a writer?
I started really writing when I was about 14 years old, primarily because I was in love with my English teacher. And I wanted to impress him. He was like just 23-year-old guy. I'm 14 years old. He's 23. And I was in love with him. Oh, my God. I was in love with him so much. And I would write stories, and I would give it to him. And that's how I got started. And pretty much to kind of dissuade the passions of a 14-year-old, he started getting me involved in theater classes and writing classes. And it was through that that I was able to – because before that, I was always a reader. I've always been a reader. And that's when I realized, oh, wow, people can actually do this. You don't have to be some sort of in my head, writers were like some sort of weird superhero kind of people. And then I found out they're not. You know, you can write. So through him, I learned to, I started writing. So around 14, 15, I started writing. It wasn't until about 17, I started writing my first grand epic. Oh, it was space opera fantasy novel. It's awful. It'll never spill out of date. It's in a box somewhere. It's just god awful. But I was 17 and I tried so hard. Anyway, so I tried. And I've started writing then. And then I've always wanted to write, but then life kind of got in the way. And, you know, life.
I got
married, I had kids, all the things. But I always wanted to be a writer, and I kept journals. I have so many journals. And I would keep my journals, and I would keep ideas for stories. And it really wasn't until about when we moved back to Tennessee in 2003 or 4, I started getting involved in the Nashville Writers Group. And that helped me really. One, you have people who are expecting you to produce. And through them, I met other people and other people. And finally, around 2013, 14, that's when I finally got my first story published. So that's a long time. That's a real long time coming. But that's just the way it was for me. Life just kind of got in the way.
Okay. And I was browsing your catalog on Amazon, and it's quite eclectic.
I'm all over the place. I know. Yeah.
So yeah. I figured I'd start at what jumped out at me the most, which was you wrote yourself a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes and the Shrieking Pits.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a bit about what led you to writing a Holmes story, and were there any challenges, you know, trying to, you know, write the greatest detective's next adventure?
Well, I love Sherlock Holmes. I always have. I'm a Jeremy Brett girl. I love the Jeremy Brett series. Benedict Cumberbatch is fine, but Jeremy Brett, well, I have a picture of him right now sitting in front of me. That's what I look at when I write my Sherlock Holmes stories. Okay, I started writing Shrieking Pits. Tommy Hancock, who is the editor of Prose, said, hey, I'm going to start this whole series of Sherlock Holmes stories. Would you like to write one? And I said, sure, no problem. What do you want me to write? Would you have a persona? What do you want? He goes, I don't care. He gave me carte blanche. The only thing I had to do is I had to keep it within the Conan Doyle canon. It had to be in that. So I said, great. So I decided I wanted to write a story that kind of gave a nod to Doyle's obsession with fairies. And also at the time I was actually reading a book about weird places, because I love the paranormal and the occult and stuff. And I was reading this particular book about weird places in England. And I happened to come across this place in Norfolk called the Shrieking Pits. Now, in the legends are that the Shrieking Pits were pits used by pagans for human sacrifices, and supposedly you can still hear their screams. And I decided, okay, I'm going to use this. I'm going to bring in the fairies. I'm going to bring in Sherlock Holmes and Watson. I'm going to keep it very Doyle. Now, the reason it's as Doyle as it is because of my editor. God love that man. He lives near Norfolk, England. He's English, and he is he's a Holmesian. He kept me grounded because I am not. I am not English. I'm not old-fashioned. I'm very much a very American. Yeah, I like to curse and drink. So he kept me very grounded. I would send him my stuff, and he would say, "No, no, Nick, this is not," and throw things out. He was the best thing that kept this as Holmesian as it is, because it's still very modern. A modern reader can read this and not be bored. Because there are a few Doyle stories that, quite frankly, just go over people's heads because they're just boring, especially towards the end of his. His writing, he didn't care about Holmes. He didn't like Sherlock Holmes. He hated the character. And
frankly, he killed him off, and then he had to bring him back. Yeah.
Like, hey, he didn't want to write stories anymore. He wanted to write his own stuff. And then when he told them, I'll bring him back for $1,000, you know, a story. And they were like, no problem. Here you go. He really expected them to go, nope. Now he's stuck. He's stuck in this contract. Not only that, he's got this terminally old wife. He's the only breadwinner of his family. So he's just writing this schlock. He hated the home stories. He wanted to push his historical stories in that no one's ever read. No one's ever going to read because they love Sherlock Holmes because he didn't understand what he created. He created this wonderful character that everyone loves. This, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Watson, they were the first cop buddy. You know, the first buddy detectives, right, frankly. You got this Apollonian mind of Sherlock Holmes with this Dionysian, earthy Watson going out and solving mysteries. It's everyone loves that. Everyone loves it. So I had a great time. So I did that. I did a lot of research on I did a lot of research on Vikings and silver. I introduced this guy by the name of Ulysses K. Todd. He's a psychical investigator. So I did a little research in the Psychical Society of England at that time, and him and his Watson, Mrs. Dowell. And they basically drag poor Holmes and Watson into this crazy adventure. And I love Todd and Dowell. I'm actually working on a series devoted just to them because it's a really cool story. And they just kind of came out of nowhere. I'm just writing this and they came out of nowhere. But yes, it's a good story. I like the story. I'm working on a couple of other Sherlock Holmes stories. One is a much darker one called Not Quite a Murder, which deals with murder, a lot of baby murders and grave robbing. And then the other one's going to be called, I forgot what it's called, but it has something to do with gin. I forgot about that. Yeah. Cause I started writing it. It's one of those stories you write and you kind of put into a box cause you get pulled into something else. And it's more of a time travel kind of thing. It's more of a cult psychical detective kind of thing that Holmes kind of gets sucked into. But it's a cool story. I hope to finish it soon. Who knows? But right now I'm kind of working on, I work on like a lot of different stories at one time because I get bored.
Yeah. I mean, I understand that pull to write something. I just had an idea today of a parent, I think a father, but it might be a mother. But they have a child. They're like, say, 5 years old, and some sort of witch or something says like, in 6 months, your child's going to die. And the story is about the parent trying to do everything to save the child and to stop this fate. And it hit me. And now I want to write it, but I'm writing like 3 book series.
Right. You're writing so many. People don't realize, people who aren't writers don't understand that we have about 5 different pots on the stove at all times. And unless someone comes up with a contract, because for me, I just write all my stuff. And someone says, hey, here's a contract, boom, write this story for me and I'll pay you X amount of money. Well, then, of course, turn off the stove and write that story. But But right now, I don't have any contracts. It's just me. And so I can work on all my stuff as long as I want. And who knows, maybe next year I'll maybe get some contracts.
Okay. So are you a pantser or a plotter?
Hybrid, quite frankly. I've thought about this a lot because every story, no matter how small or whether or not it even gets finished, has a journal. Every Derisa Regis has a journal. It's like a little womb. And I write, and as long as I understand the beginning, as long as I understand where I want to go, the rest of it I just kind of like make happen. But I do write to myself. I talk to myself, and the characters talk to me inside the journal. Like I'll say, okay, so what do I want to happen here? And then it's a makeshift kind of outline, but it's not like some sort of anal outline where I have to boom, 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 boom. I know there are certain points and certain beats you need to do in a story. And there are beats in a story that you need to hit. But I'm a hybrid. I do both because as long as I know where I'm shooting my arrow, I can hit the target. But if I don't have an end, I get really, I'm worried. I need to know where I'm going. But that middle squishy part in the middle, I'm God. I can do whatever I want. That's gonna that will take care of itself usually. When I wrote the second Jake Ishanhedgi story, Golems, Goons, and Coldstone Bitches, it's my favorite Jake story. Primarily because I just said, okay, I went upstairs, got into my bed, got my journal out, and went, okay, so what do we want to do? And the first scene just kind of came to me in a vision. I wrote that down, and that's cool. But it just ends with this woman dying in his arms, and she's like, and she says to him, "Oh my God, is it here? Is it here?" And he says, "What do you mean? Oh my God, am I too late? Oh, am I too early?" And then she dies. So the question is, what is she talking about? I didn't even have a clue. Not a clue. All I knew is that she asks him, "Am I too late?" And then she says, "Am I too early?" And then she dies. Sure. So that was cool. So that I could roll with this. And then I just kind of roll with it. And I was very, very happy with how that story ended. And I was very surprised. And kudos for the story gods, because they kind of just pulled me along. And I just was there just being a little scribe. It's one of my favorite stories in the Jake series.
Yeah. I don't really feel like, I kind of feel like I'm in pretty good control. But I of course allow my subconscious to, you know, to work its, to do its job. So like when I have impulses that go against my outline, and it's my subconscious, you know, going like, hey, this is something that you like, it'll put pieces together that my conscious mind hadn't realized, that lets me like tie up like story themes and stuff like that. And like, I'll be writing and I'll be in the middle of writing, I'll be like, oh wait, this is going to connect with that I wrote earlier. Okay. And we just modify this. And yeah. Or, you know, I'll have like problems I need to solve, and I'm like, okay, I need to put this somewhere in the book. And, you know, usually I'll find it, hopefully on the rough draft, but sometimes I have to go back on the rewrites to figure out where I need to put that, you know, but yeah.
The first draft is where you're just trying to find the story. So your first draft, I mean, I used to run a lot of critique groups when I was with the Nashville Writers Group. And I used to tell all the people who come to my groups, because they were young, they were newbies, and they would bring this huge book in, and I would tell them, this is great. See these first six chapters, toss them. Your story starts here. And people don't understand that sometimes you can write six chapters before your story really begins. And I just put those six chapters in what I call my abortion file. Boop, you go over there, and maybe I'll use you later for something, but right now you're nothing. So, and it starts there. But yeah, I think Neil Gaiman once talked about how once he wrote a story, and for some strange reason, there was a rocking chair. I don't know why there's a rocking chair, but there is. And then later on, he realized, oh, that's why there's a rocking chair. He just sometimes you just have to let the story tell itself, because I don't want to get all woo woo, but sometimes stories are magical. And sometimes the story just what needs to be told and tells itself. I once took this class, and the teacher, his biggest thing was telling us that writers were the bridge between mythos and logos. We were the bridge, and that myth could be able to be told into the world as logos, as word.
Yeah, that's kind of very Jungian, isn't it? You know,
very.
I like Jung. Yeah, he believes.
I'm all
in
about Jungian. When I do a tarot, I read tarot.
The collective unconsciousness.
Yes. When I read tarot for people, I tell them this is a Jungian. Pretty much, I use a Jungian experimentation. This isn't magic. I can't tell you the future, but I can tell you where you are right now, and that's much more important through the cards and through a Jungian interpretation of the cards. That's how I read tarot.
Fair enough.
So
yeah. Like I really like his idea of the shadow self.
Yes, the shadow self.
When you can understand your shadow self and understand the bad parts of your personality, the destructive parts that you can, if you need to understand yourself if you want to try to avoid those impulses and
also to become more actualized, become a person. You have to hug your shadow self, not be afraid of your bad impulses or what you consider bad, quote air quotation marks bad. Your shadow self. So that's just your mean ego, or actually probably your younger self, your child self, that doesn't care about what society wants. It knows what it wants and what it needs.
Yeah.
And that it needs to survive. And your shadow self is fine. It's not evil. It's something you need to incorporate into yourself if you want to become a full human being. That's what I believe. I have no idea. I could be completely blowing this out my butt. I don't know. But it works for me, and I'm not in therapy. So there we go.
Yeah. No, I think being self-reflective is a good thing.
Mm.
And I think it helps me with my writing, you know, to understand why I do things, to help understand why my characters do things.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't I had a question someone asked me recently about how much did I think of myself was in my characters. And I remembered I saw John Irving at he came to Nashville at the Ryman Auditorium and gave a free talk. It was great. I went all the way downtown to listen to him talk. And the one thing I took away from it, he said, every fledgling writer has to understand that you're not interesting and not to make the character about you. Okay. Cause you're not. No one flesh and blood is as interesting as someone made of fiction. Okay. Nobody. Well, I'm sure there are, but your average Joe is not. And not to do that because nobody wants to hear about you, that you want. And also as a writer, you grow. None of my characters are really me. Some of them are people I wish I could be. I wish I had the balls to be that strong, you know, to be that courageous.
Oh, I get that.
But
yeah.
I'm not courageous. I'm very much not. I wish I was, but I'm not.
I have used some aspects of myself. Like my character Ari from the Stormblow series, he has my temper, which so I know I have it, and so I try not to let it rule me, because, you know, but that's that's like his struggle kind of early in the books is mastering his temper, especially under very stressful situations.
I'm a very angry person. I've had several teachers tell me everything you write is angry. Even if you write kittens, they'd be angry kittens. When I was giving birth to my son, the doctor just went, oh, you're one of the angry ones. Okay, it's cool. Because I scared the nurse. I was not being really cool and composed while in labor. And he just went, oh, you're one of the angry ones. So that's okay. Don't worry about it. Let her scream. Let her throw things. She'll be fine. And that's when I realized, you're right. I am one of the angry ones. And I am a very angry person. And I don't let it control me. You can use that energy. Oh, man, I use that energy to get stuff done. Anger gets stuff done. Pratchett said that. He was talking to Neil Gaiman about when they were doing Good Omens. He was like, the only reason we got this book done is because I'm angry. I'm a very angry person. I was like,
really? I'm like a very laid back person. Usually I'm kind of unruffled. So that's why when my temper comes out, it comes out really
bad. Does it scare people when you get angry?
Yeah, it's scared people.
That's like my husband. He's a right. Everyone, he's that dude.
Because I'm that guy. Yeah, that's me. I'm the guy who's, you know, in a social situation, I'm the person that's like not interacting with anyone. Because I'm such an introvert that I can't handle large groups unless I know a lot of the people there.
I'll fake it. I'm a theater girl.
I can't. Like if it's important. If I'm at a marketing thing or a work thing, you know.
Yeah, you put the face on.
Yeah, I'll force myself. I can force myself to do it. But if I don't need to force myself to do it, I will just sort of hang back and listen. I'll listen and I'll.
Oh, listen. Know. Just listen and go and learn all the things. Sit back, be very professional, and have a plan to kill everyone in the room. That's pretty much how I do at a party. You know, I'm just, okay, this is how it goes. But my husband's the same way. He is that quiet guy who sits in the back, doesn't say very much at all. And then when I tell people, oh, yeah, he was a sniper in the Marine Corps. What? Oh, yeah, he did this, and he had several different wars, blah, blah. Like, him? I'm like, yeah, what were you expecting? Brian is really very – also, he's a great adherent of the Stoic philosophy. Don't get him started on the Stoics.
I
love the Stoics, but it's just – oh, my God. He drives me crazy. When we have an argument, he'll pull up Stoicism. And I'm like, okay, now I'm going to have to kill you because I'm just sorry now. I have to kill you now.
I have a friend who was a Ranger sniper. With the second Rangers, but yeah, he wouldn't think he was.
No.
Like, just knowing him.
Look, everyone I've ever met, because I mean, Brian was in the Marine Corps for 23 years, so I was a Marine Corps wife for 23 years. Every guy I ever met who was in war, I've never met a person who's been in war who wants war. No. Those guys, they never talk about it. Never. The people who talk about it, blah, blah, they've never seen war. You've never been there. Because the guys I've met who saw things, they don't want it.
That's what I try to capture in my military fantasy, like what the cost in war and just how it wears on the soul.
Humans really aren't.
It's the worst. No, we're not. We don't actually like hurting each other.
We have to
really much go against our instincts to hurt each other.
Yes, we don't like it. It destroys us psychologically. And we're, even though I know that probably to the more sentient alien races, we seem like war monkeys, but we're really not. We just got, you know, anger issues, but we're not. We don't like war. I mean, we just don't. And it's not good for anybody. And it's just a stupid waste of life. It's just a stupid waste of life. And war only happens when diplomacy breaks down. So it just makes me so angry when I think about it. Anyway, yes, that was Sherlock. So what else?
we're actually out of time. Where can our listeners find you on the internet?
I'm sorry, what? Find me on the internet?
Okay,
I am on Facebook. You can find me there. Just Google my name or look for Nick, N-I-K-C-U-B-E-D, Nick Cubed. I'm on Twitter at Nick Cubed, N-I-K-C-U-B-E-D. I'm on Instagram. I have a blog on WordPress. Just go to WordPress, look up Nikki Nelson Hicks. And all my books are on Amazon. Just Google me up. They're in Kindle and paperback, all the bits.
Yeah, she's got some interesting stuff. She's got some steampunk, some weird western, a noir detective series, I think I saw.
That's a Jackie Shinheji, the voodoo noir. And I'm really, my rumble is a cryptid clash between Mongolian deathworms and cannibalistic mole people and a poor mercenary group that gets stuck in the middle. It's great fun.
Yeah, so you got some pulp in there too. Nice.
I'm all about the pulp. All about the pulp.
Well, it's really great talking with you, Nikki.
Thank you. It was fun.
It was.
Okay.
Give yourself a good one.
Oh, thank you. Okay, thanks.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com, and follow me on Twitter at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.